You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome to the Luminaries. This is a very special episode. I've never done anything like this, but we are going to be reading the astrology of Cristina La Veneno Ortiz. To do that, I've recruited beloved previous guest and astrological maven, Dexter Driscoll. Dexter, welcome.
Thank you for having me, David.
Naturally. Be sure to speak up, by the way.
Yes, I'm sorry. I was being coy.
Not in this house. Okay. So just to lay out some ground rules, I have called on La Veneno to be with us and guide us, but we are doing this reading as two people who watch the show, who have looked into her, who were really moved by her impact. So this is a reading we're doing for a sense of illumination and out of love. And this is not meant to be like a binding scripture. I welcome if anyone is listening to this and they are noticing things we're not noticing or they disagree with our interpretations, please let us know. And of course, I'm dying to do Paca La Piranha's astrology. And if we can get someone who is very good at Spanish language astrological vocabulary who could be a intermediary, please let me know. And yeah, what else? Is there anything else you'd like to add, Dexter, before we start?
No, I'm excited to see where this goes. I think, yeah, it's just, this is the show of the last year for me. And so many.
Yeah, it's kind of the show of the last decade. Just to think about, like, in 2013, watching the Transparent pilot on Amazon, and then, like, being here and just understanding the quantum leap. And I don't know, I've just been thinking a lot about, like, how many fucking Ryan Murphy shows have we had to slog through because we are so used to inane mediocrity when it comes to queer representation. And then when this happened, it was like, oh, right. Like, we have to have a standard because this is the standard, you know?
Right. And I think it's also brilliant because it's like we are in this like time of quote unquote 90s nostalgia that we've been in for a very long time at this
point.
And this feels just like the perfect culmination and maybe the only 90s nostalgia that I like really want. And yes. it's there's just so much justice.
Yes. There is. And without further ado, I guess let's jump in. So, this chart that Dexter and I are reading, we're using whole sign houses, which is just a way of breaking a chart down so that each sign is in one of the 12 houses of astrology. Just to give you a bit of an intro, astrology, when you look at a chart, there's 12 houses. If you think of the wheel of a zodiac, kind of like a hero's journey, there's 12 houses. Each house represents something different. So the first house is kind of the hatching individual self. And then we come to the 12th house, which is kind of closure, personal history, the end of the story. Okay. So within each house, based on a person's rising sign, which is the sign that was breaking on the eastern horizon when they were born, the rising would be the first sign, which goes in the first house, and then we can kind of order out everything else. I do want to state as a disclaimer, this chart reading is based off of the time that La Veneno lists for her birth in her memoir and on the show, which is at the stroke of midnight on this specific night in 1964. I have no doubt that that is an incorrect time. I find it unlikely that she was born at the stroke of midnight. However, as we will see, is a recurring theme in this chart, and which was a recurring theme for La Veneno, and you know, as very much addressed in the show, we kind of have to take her word for it. So this reading is I don't think it's going to be 100% precise, but it's the reading, it's the story of her life that she gave us, and we are doing the reading of her life based on the story of her life. So, you know, just keep that in mind. So without further ado, let's get going. I think we should start with her rising sign, Dexter.
Okay.
We have, yeah, go for it.
I mean, so according to Stroke of Midnight, it is Scorpio, which is kind of the only possible rising sign, in my opinion, for her, just because Scorpio, of course, is death and rebirth. So I think when I think about most forms of gender fluidity, it's either Aquarius or Scorpio, because there's either a rising from the ashes, regeneration, or embracing of the queer, which would be Aquarius, versus the regenerative Scorpio.
Okay, thank you for saying that, because this very week I've been wondering, I'm like, why do I know so many goddamn Scorpio risings, and why have I been reading so many Scorpio risings? And then it's like, oh right, it's because it is people who are driven by that metamorphosis, by that death and rebirth. Yeah.
Also, you just like talk to a lot of gay people.
Yes, which is unfortunate for me. you know, so she's Scorpio rising. She is born in the generation that had Neptune in Scorpio. So, you know, Neptune moves like every 20 years or something. So it's not so unique that she would have Neptune in Scorpio, but she has Neptune in Scorpio in the first house. And this is like, we are already off to the races. So Neptune, if we think of as the kind of shared consciousness and like emotional landscape, it's also very much the dreamscape. It's very much the shared unconscious cinemascape. And of course, fantasies, delusions, substances, and escape. And when we see that in the first house, it's already like, okay, on a fundamental identity, like soul level, she's already, there's already a veneer of fantasy, which with Scorpio means she gets to be reborn into this kind of fantastic self-image, but it also means that her sense of maybe self-definition is kind of lost in the ocean a bit. What do you think about that?
I mean, I also think that it would make sense as to why there are all the disclaimers about this is her mythology, not her fact.
Yes.
Because I think Scorpio especially is unwilling to accept anything but the highest truth. And they're unwilling to accept anything but, you know, integrity. That's why people are like, oh, like they don't like me. And it's like, no, it's just that like you aren't like cool and with it.
Right. Like that's why Fran Lebowitz, who is a Scorpio, is not gonna like entertain you.
Right. So I think it would make sense why a Scorpio rising with Neptune in the first house of Scorpio would find the dreamscape, the fantasy, to be the most authentic and for that to be validated.
You know, to continue that theme, we then go to Scorpio makes a trine, so a supportive angle to a planet in its own element, to the water sign Pisces. In this case, we have Chiron, Mars, and the Sun in Pisces, which is like
it's a lot of water.
It's a lot of water, and Pisces is, so Pisces is the ocean. Neptune rules Pisces, so Pisces is the ocean of human consciousness. So Pisces, there is no definition, no boundaries. It's pure empathy, intuition, vision. And we have Pisces in the fifth house of creativity, sex, motherhood, romance, and pleasure. So here we have the sun, which is kind of where Veneno's vitality and her radiance emerges. We have her Mars. How would you describe Mars generally?
I think of Mars as the physical self. I think of it as like, as quote unquote, our hardware, and also as how we exert. So, and that's both in love and war. Like I think of Venus more as how we flirt and how, and our vanity in flirting, like, because when we flirt, we try and be seen how we want to be seen, not how we are. So I think of like Mars as how we love and fight. It's like, it's, it tells how someone is a lover, how someone, you know, will come for you if need be.
And okay, so Mars and the sun, obviously the two things you think of with both of them is fire. So Mars and the sun, it's very much two planets about like individualism, shining, kind of emerging. And the issue with Mars and the sun together is that you get like a double dose of fire. I wrote this quote down from Alan Oaken. It's a daredevil with no holds barred. So when you have a sun and Mars together, it's like, uh-oh, watch out, because there's going to be a temper. There's going to be, like you said, love and war. There's going to be like some war. The issue is that we have Mars and the sun in Pisces. So if we think about these two like sizzling, hot, burning, surging planets getting like dunked into the ocean, basically.
Right.
Which makes it even more, Mars then is like simmering, because Mars, it doesn't get to express itself as cogently. So there's this sense of like, usually with Mars and Pisces, I'm like, okay, you got stepped on as a child and now you're kind of simmering with rage sometimes. please, I'd love to hear your thoughts, because by the way, your thoughts about Mars and Pisces, just so everyone knows, Dexter and I are both Mars and Pisces, and Dexter's knowledge of this did kind of rock my world.
I don't think that what you said is inaccurate, at least for myself, but I always think of Mars in Pisces. Well, actually, I saw some hilarious and truthful memes or Tumblr posts at some point on Mars placements, and Mars in Pisces was described as the romantic slut, which is like, we'll fuck you, but we have to kiss while we do it. You know, it's like,
hi. Which,
right. Literally, like, people are like, I don't like to kiss unless I'm in love. And I'm like, grow up. But Mars and Pisces, it is the bombshell. It's like all of our screen sirens, our archetypal screen sirens are Mars and Pisces. I think I'm, of course, very partial to this definition because it validates me. I'm Venus and Aries, Mars and Pisces.
Same.
Which we share that with Elizabeth Taylor and Marilyn Monroe. So I love that definition, and I also think that it's accurate. So there is this like bombshell sex symbol.
Because Mars, essentially, Mars is this expression of sexuality. Pisces is, like I said earlier, Pisces is very much a cinematic sign. Pisces is very much about the collective unconscious. So there's this idea when you see someone with Mars in Pisces that they're able to live out the fantasy. They're able to project the fantasy. And of course, Veneno in the first episode of the show says, you know, you're about to see La Bomba de España, which is the Spanish bombshell. So it's like ding, ding, ding.
Right. I also think the image that you were giving of Mars and the sun being drenched in the ocean, the vibe that I got from that is like a bathhouse, because it's like, it's just steam everywhere. And then to have this in the fifth house would make it so it's like the bathhouse is the stage and she is under the spotlight. So which would make sense, you know, if she's working in the park and she's the one that gets all the clients.
Yes.
Her stage is the sexual realm and she is the star of it. So it just makes total sense, which also just works with Scorpio rising, just communicating sex with ease and skill.
And actually, if we look at, you know, so every sign has rulers. Pisces is ruled by Neptune, which, as we said, is this kind of dreams, unconsciousness, invisible forces. And Pisces is also ruled by Jupiter. Jupiter is abundance and kind of intellectual expansion. Jupiter is in Veneno's sixth house of work, service, and the body. Jupiter, in Veneno's case, is in Aries. Aries is another fire sign, extremely individualistic. I always associate Aries with, like, truly body, body, body. Like, I think Aries is very much about, it's not super cognitive. It's very much about, like, the somatic affect experience of, like, this feels good, I'm horny, I want to do this. So when we see Jupiter, which is this kind of planet of abundance, in the house of work, service, and the body, Jupiter is also ruled by Sagittarius. We see Sagittarius is in her second house of like earning money, personal resources, values, and we see Lilith here too. So there's definitely a lot of connection between money, pleasure, work, and the body, kind of binding it all together.
Right. I also think that I agree with that, except I would just edit that. I think of Aries more as impulse versus the body, because whereas Taurus is the body, like, Aries is the one that is a child and looks at the stove and sees that it's bright red and is like, oh, it's pretty, let's touch it.
So that's much better. Yes.
But also the impulsiveness would absolutely serve when you're in a conservative, repressive society that doesn't want you to be who you are. There is the impulsiveness to be like, oh, well, I like the attention. I want to go out there. It's going to feel good in the moment, not caring about the consequences, which I think is also deeply important to her, which is also why Aries is the initiator, because they don't care what the consequences are. So that's why we need that energy in someone who is going to break boundaries the way that Love and Eno did.
Yeah, and yeah, that's great. I mean, her Mercury is like communication and self-expression, is in that sixth house of work, service, and the body. So yeah, to me, I think her idea of how she could express herself or how she could earn, I think was a bit limited to this very Aries, like, I do this and then I get money. Like, it's very obviously transactional, obviously, and very much rooted in this idea of service, which I love in that first episode when they're trying to get her to be a star and, like, she doesn't even understand what they're talking about. And
right. There isn't a sense of the long term.
No. Like, I think if we look at, she has Lilith in Sagittarius. So Lilith represents kind of the dark side of the moon's elliptical. Lilith in biblical mythology was Adam's first wife, who was kicked out of the Garden of Eden for demanding parity. She became basically this, like, symbol of exiled female sexuality, this kind of, like, wandering she demon hag. And she's very much like a queer and a feminist symbol for exile and reclamation. But Lilith in a chart represents this kind of central moment of exile that's reclaimed. When we see Lilith in her second house of earning and personal values, and Lilith is in Sagittarius. Sagittarius thinks very big. Sagittarius is all about pushing the needle forward, all about confrontation. So, and expansive ideas, right? So there is, I get a sense when I see, and I'd love to know what you think, Dexter, but I get a sense when I see Lilith in that second house of earning that there was some sort of a central wound or some sort of a central experience where her ability to dream big for herself in terms of how she could earn, what her values could be, how she could sustain herself were likely curtailed by the rejection of her values, of her ideology, and of her existence as this kind of forward-pushing being of consciousness. But I'm wondering if you see anything there.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there's definitely the element where she was aware that her options were limited if she were to be authentic. Mm. So, because there are, in the first few episodes, we do see that in her 20s, before she came out or began the process of her physical transformation, she was working as a hairdresser, which, you know, to be a gay person, that's how you make money for, that's the option for a lot of people. So she was doing, you know, the quote unquote, like, responsible thing given her circumstances. And she seemed to be doing okay in every aspect, except that she wasn't being authentic to herself. Mm. So I think the Scorpio rising was like, okay, well, I know that's not going to work in the long run. And it makes sense that there would be just an issue with financial security in the long run, given the Lilith placement, I guess.
So let's continue with, well, let's look at her moon, if that's okay. Her moon is in Gemini, which is not... Let's just zoom back a little. You know, we have a Scorpio rising and we have a Pisces sun, which is not the easiest. Let me just tell you, this morning when I was looking up Pisces suns and Scorpio risings, we have like Harvey Weinstein and Grimes. It's just not like, it's not easy. Pisces sun generally, it's extremely powerful. Like we said, she's tapped into this, you know, a Pisces sun, she has this incredible power where she's so tapped into this, like, into this vision, into this fantasy, into this consciousness. And she was so, that's what made her a visionary. But it makes you extremely sensitive, extremely vulnerable. Like, it's empathy almost to, you know, when it's kind of at threat, it's like an unsheltered vulnerability. So it's very difficult, obviously.
It's easy to become overcome by your own experience.
Yes, which leads us to this Gemini moon, because, okay, again, I love my Pisces and I love the Geminis in my life. I am so thankful for them. However, and Dexter, I'd love to hear what you think about this. I'm about to lose so many clients because anyone who's a Gemini who's listening is like, I'm never working with him, but...
Okay. I'm just going to add my mother is a Gemini and I'll take your clients.
Okay.
All the lost Gemini toys come to me.
Gemini is the sign of expression. Gemini is this clear and cogent kind of portal for expression, communication. Gemini is very much about living in the experience and embodying it. The issue with mm-hmm. Gemini, which we then see with, you know, Azalea Banks, Kanye West, Donald Trump, is that it can be hard going from experience to build any sort of wisdom or framework or perspective. So a lot of my Gemini friends, I'll be like, okay, so have we learned anything this month? Because there is just this sense of, like, you know, the higher Geminis, we think about, okay, I'm getting in so much trouble for this, but if we think about Alanis Morissette or Robin or Naomi Campbell, yes, it is this hyper-personal, hyper egocentric view, but it's able to be transmitted into a universal way. Gemini energy, though, is very tricky because it's very hard to put all the pieces together. Does that sound right to you?
So I think, yes, I would add that I think with Geminis, their superpower is that, like you were saying, they embody things. They know their archetypes. They know their archetypes and they perform them.
Yes.
So when, and they know how to do it at the right time. So, but they very much are going with the flow. So when the elements aren't perfect, that's when it can get dicey.
Yes.
But like, I think about, which also again, Marilyn created the modern archetype of the bombshell movie star because she was like, this is what it is. And she literally created a new goddess archetype for us. Naomi created, when you think of a supermodel, if you, you know, unless you are much older and are thinking of like Twiggy and 60s supermodels, you're thinking of Naomi. She is the archetype. I think like Kylie Minogue is such a successful pop star because she has her reinventions. They're subtle, but she's very precise in the execution because she knows how to do it. So I think with the Nenno, looking at her moon in Gemini, I think there's an acute awareness of what, it's like there's that push and pull between the Scorpio rising and the Gemini moon, where it's like there's an acute awareness of what archetype someone needs emotionally, which I think is brilliant as a sex worker because mm-hmm. most people are going for an emotional experience. So you can provide perfectly and you know how to manipulate based on what their needs are. I think also to be an entertainer and to be on a talk show, it's like, this is the emotional truth of this moment. This is how I can perform it perfectly to be received. So that's how I would look at it.
Yeah, that's amazing because if we think about that Neptune in that first house, which is this kind of cinematic self-projection, and then we come to the Gemini moon, you know, in that first episode, I love when they say like, are you a man or a woman? And she's like, I'm a traffic light. And she is able to obviously play with the duality and the binaries. But yes, there is very much this aspect of like, I can tell you what you want me to be before you know what you want me to be. You know, the moon, to zoom out for a minute, the moon represents, if her sun is where she comes out in the world, the moon is kind of where she gets her sense of security and her sense of nourishment. I mean, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think, and it's emotional security. Yeah. So it actually, and the moon is funny because it's like, you need, obviously the moon's needs need to be satiated, but it's not, obviously it's not the same as the sun's needs. So like, for example, I'm like, I'm a Sag moon and I need to know that I have the option to travel. Do I need to travel? I'm a Taurus. I can do it and I love it and I will do it. But as long as I know that like I have a trip in like 3 years, I don't care.
Right. So as long as you know that freedom is there, it's not the same as like being sucked up in it all the time. That makes sense. I mean,
right.
Her moon, let's just say this, is not just in Gemini. Her Gemini is in the eighth house. The eighth house is the original domain of Scorpio. The eighth house is the house of sex, death, once again, metamorphosis. And it's also the house of, I think, life cycles of like, someone in the family dies. This is the inheritance you get. Now you're the new matriarch of the family. So
we have other people's money.
Other people's money, which we are really going to get into. I hadn't thought about that aspect too. So yeah, it's the house of other people's money. And Gemini is ruled by Mercury. Like we said earlier, she has her Mercury in the sixth house of work, service, and the body. So this idea of, and her Mercury is with Jupiter, which is kind of the planet of excess. So when it comes to sex, and when it comes to the body, there is this, her sun and moon are both extremely active. So for her, there is this sense of throwing herself into it, which we understand. Like for her, it's not really about, you know, despite the Scorpio rising, it's not really about the big picture thinking. It's just about like, put me in and I will give it to you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The moon, and this is where things start to get Dicey, you know, the moon has a nice trine, a sextile, a supportive aspect with Mars and with the sun and with Mercury. So we see that all of those things are in alignment, that kind of that fantasy projection, that body, all of that. The moon has two kind of explosive squares. A square is like a 90 degree angle in a chart, a challenge, a confrontation. The first square I'm looking at is the moon is squared by Saturn. Saturn is the planet of like rules, restriction, time. And Saturn is in Aquarius in Veneno's fourth house of home and family.
Which is what we're entering right now, which is probably why it's so...
I know. It's crazy. We're entering what would have been her second Saturn return. And Aquarius is like an air sign for new technology and for dissemination of information. So you're right.
And queerness.
And queerness. So during her second Saturn return, we're getting this kind of...
wisdom and tribute.
Yes. On a much bigger level than she probably ever could have imagined. Because she's now... The show is a global phenomenon. I'm listening to her songs on Spotify. But when we see Saturn, like I said, the fourth house is the base of the chart. The fourth house is the house of home and family. And when we see Saturn there, you know, Saturn is kind of can act as like a gatekeeper, and it can act as like a source of lessons. And when we see Saturn in that fourth house squaring her moon in the eighth house of metamorphosis, if we think about her emotional need to transform, her emotional need to embrace her sexual power, her emotional need for kind of death and rebirth being checked or challenged by this authority figure in the fourth house, you know, Saturn moon, because moon is very divine feminine, when we see a Saturn moon, often it means mommy issues. It often means a harsh kind of mother figure who becomes an outer and inner critic. So we can look at her chart. We already see this. It's almost like a force holding her moon back from getting that emotional security. So she can go through these transformations, but that Saturn is almost always pulling her back home.
Which, of course, is the reality of the show with her and real life with her very restrictive mother who was the source of most of her trauma.
Yes. And the moon,
well, I won't say most, a lot of it.
Yeah. The moon is also squared by Uranus, which, well, let's get into it because Veneno has an extremely powerful Uranus. Uranus is the planet. I'd actually love to know how you would describe Uranus in a person's chart. Dexter.
I think it's how you are within your community. And my definition is very close, just my definition of Aquarius, where it's like looking at the house placement, like what's the queer element, what's the social element. And since it is like an outer planet, honestly, I probably should do some more reading on Uranus. But the outer planets, I just kind of look at the house placement because it is generational. And
I love that. I mean, I think of Uranus, I love that you're thinking of it as like this kind of queer fly in the ointment. Yeah, Uranus is very much about, to me, it's kind of like the thing that's meant to shake up and fuck up your life so that you wake up to your higher consciousness. So it's like the thing that's meant to like push you out of the closet, to continue what you're saying, right?
Right. It's like Saturn and Aquarius are like opposing forces. It's almost, I would say devil and an angel, but I don't think either is. It's but like one on each shoulder being like, but this.
Yeah, Saturn, it's chaos and order, like Saturn and Uranus. And both Saturn and Uranus are the co-rulers of Aquarius. So there's this idea with Aquarius that the Aquarian vision of changing the world requires this queer Uranian element, and it requires this very Saturnian, like, okay, this is how we're going to do it.
Right. There needs to be structure. You need to know the rules to break them.
I love that. Venenos Uranus is in her 11th house. It's in its home domain, actually. It's in the original domain of Aquarius, which is the 11th house of network, community, and higher ideals. It's in Virgo. Virgo is the original domain of the 6th house, which is work, service, and the body. And it is right on her midheaven. So the midheaven is like the peak of your chart. The midheaven, we look to the midheaven for basically your, the emergence of your public, your career role. Your midheaven to me is kind of where you most emerge in the world. So when we see Uranus right up on that midheaven, we're like, okay, her career destiny is revolutionary. It's meant to totally fuck up the system. And it's in that 11th house of network and community. So it's meant to be a revolutionary idealist who leads the way for this specific community.
And it's Virgo. It's the presentation of like the perfect body. And it also is her, the destiny being in the work versus, it's interesting because the destiny is about, it all came through just kind of going forward without the bigger career plan.
Yeah. And I love, there is a Virgo. I love kind of the Virgo aspect too, because I mean, a lot of the culture she was in is very, I associate with Virgo because Virgo is very much like, you know, Virgo likes taking an advisory position. Virgo likes literally like breaking things down. Virgo likes reading people. And a lot of the community she came from, especially when we see like her rivalry with Fanny and the standards which she had to live in to like become, you know, so powerful, are very Virgo, which are very this very hard, high perfectionist standards. And then a lot of the work she did as a public figure was based on this, to me, a very Virgo through expression, which is like, I'm going to read something really quickly. I'm going to break it down. I'm going to tell you what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's bad. Like, she needed to constantly be like spitting opinions from this place of perfection, which I do associate with a lot of that culture.
Which also suits the Gemini moon because they're both very mercurial and just precise in execution. Also, the other thing that I'm thinking about, just because obviously her body was such a big part of her career and her infamy and fame, is that each sign has a correlation to an age, from Aries, the infant, to Pisces, the elder. And Virgo is very much like the teenager come into their own and like ripe for the taking. So her physical body being presented as this perfect sexual creature is absolutely when her legend became, you know, once her body changed, she was never able to continue, which of course is a comment on misogyny and in et cetera in the greater culture, but it is supported by the chart.
And yeah, because we also find her Pluto right there. So Pluto rules Scorpio. Pluto is the planet of death and metamorphosis. It's kind of our personal underworld, and it is this site that once we've undergone metamorphosis becomes this bastion of power. So there is this idea that in that 11th house in Virgo, we find, yes, the source of reinvention, power, this kind of total recreation of trans identity and imagery and sexual expression, but it is kind of also like an endpoint, which is a lot of those rules would, I don't want to say lead to a downfall, but her underworld, it definitely is like the site of her underworld. I think we can say that.
Yeah. And also I would say that I would just add that Gemini and Virgo are both also very fluid gender-wise because of the Mercury element. So that's why it's kind of extra lovely that she said, they're like, are you a man or a woman? And she said, what, I'm a
traffic light. And
I'm a traffic light. Cause yeah. It's like, she obviously is, I believe defines herself as a trans woman, I believe.
Yeah.
But also is acutely aware of this sort of gender fluidity that is, and this queerness within her, which I think is so gorgeous.
I love that you say that because Virgo is thought of often as the Sphinx because Virgo comes between Leo and Libra. So if we think of the body of the lion and then the head of the goddess, which is Libra. So Virgo is the Sphinx. And the idea that her midheaven is right on Uranus in Virgo and has her coming out on TV and being like, I am duality. I am everything and nothing, like, you're never going to get me, you're never going to like be able to categorize me, is so major. And even like if we think about what the show has done, because to me the show rocked my world, if we think about the show's Uranian Aquarian capacity, the way that the show didn't do the American thing of being like, well, we'd hire trans actors, we just don't know how to do it. This show, they were like, we're hiring trans women. We're hiring three trans women. No, four trans women, because we also have Lola Vasquez, who plays Valeria. And even when they're playing themselves at different parts of the transition, we'll figure it out. But there is this sense of like, I don't know. There's a reclamation of that. And there's a breaking down of the boundaries of even performances of transness on screen, which is like, well, we'll get a cis person to play them at this phase of their transition. No, we can actually like fuck that whole thing up, you know?
Hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just, I also know, like, since I am not, Spanish, I'm like, I don't know if there's also, I wonder how a Spanish person from Spain feels. Like, I'm sure it's universally loved and it's a great production, but I wonder if someone's thoughts would be on it from that perspective, because I'm very critical of queer stuff in our culture.
Yeah,
but it's like not either because it touches a point or because I'm just like, that's like, what is that, you know? I wonder if that, there's that experience too.
That's interesting. I mean, I think about that a lot. I think the reason why like Fleabag was such a hit is because it's set in another country. So we're able to look in a mirror, but it's not our exact mirror. And I do feel the same way.
I hated that show.
Oh, I go off. I love that.
Yeah, no, it's a terrible show. Everybody watch Sally Forever instead. It's much better.
Sally Forever is the most satanic thing I think I've ever seen in my life. It is. I was crying. I was laughing so hard, but I think I'm also like traumatized forever. Nothing will ever compare to Sally Forever.
No, nothing. It's truly that. Yeah.
But I do want to just say, like, there is, I think when you're watching something set in your own country, especially when it comes to like class or gender, it's brings up a lot of ugliness. When you're watching something set in another culture that is similar to your experience, but not exactly, I do think it's easier to receive it.
Right, because watching Veneno, it's perfect. I love it. And I also do see certain elements that are a little soap opera after school special.
Totally.
It's not a problem for me, but if I were Spanish, I might be like, really?
Totally. Yeah, I agree with that. So a few interesting things with this Uranus. So Uranus is ruled by Aquarius. Like we said earlier, she has Aquarius in that fourth house of home ancestry. So there is, first of all, this idea of obviously like the revolution begins at home and the revolution ends at home, because that Uranian energy of Aquarius, her Saturn is right at the tail end of Aquarius too. So her Saturn, it's almost like she can come all the way, and then there's like this final gatekeeper. Her Saturn is very, Actually, it's interesting. I'm listening to Stephen Fry's Mythos, and in original Greek mythology, Saturn kills Uranus. Uranus in Greek mythology is Saturn's Kronos's father, and Kronos kills Uranus. So that's just kind of interesting. There is this like hard line waiting for her at home. But I want to say
Saturn also is the father, and it is interesting that her father, at least in the show, at the very, it's like, and of course, 29 degrees, at the very end is when he can advocate for her. He can't do it his entire life.
Yeah.
Her entire life. And then at her death is when he pushes to get some respect for her burial.
Oh, that's pretty amazing. I hadn't thought about that. That Uranus is squared by her moon. So we have moon squaring Saturn, and then we have this moon squaring Uranus, which is tough because to me, I think like a moon Uranus square would be itinerancy, rootlessness, maybe a sense of a temper, just because Uranus is all about constant upheaval, constant change, constant uprooting. And the moon is very much about security. So then we have it in the houses of network and community, and in the houses of sex, death, and metamorphosis. So to me, there's this sense of never feeling really grounded. I mean, it's definitely a moon Uranus thing, is, you know, obviously kind of growing up with a lack of a sense of safety or a sense of security. And that definitely kind of tracks, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As a Saturn in Aquarius in the fourth house, it tracks.
You are a Saturn in Aquarius. I thought you were Saturn in Aquarius in the fifth house.
No, fourth house. Yeah.
Wow, babe. Okay. Okay, we'll get into that. Okay.
We'll get into that.
What's interesting about her chart with all of the elements, and there's still more we're going to talk about, but if we just look at all the elements we've talked about, which is like this moon, Uranus, Neptune, Mars, Sun, it almost forms a rectangle. We almost get what's called in astrology a mystic rectangle, which is a harmonious rectangle pattern in a person's chart, which usually, I mean, this is my interpretation of mystic rectangles. When we see them, it usually means that this person is able to act as a channel for kind of generational cultural change that works through them, through their work, through their art. With Veneno, it's kind of amazing because we almost have a mystic rectangle and it looks like it's been broken. It looks like it's literally falling apart. So there's this kind of tragedy with Veneno where it's like, she's clearly this vessel of higher consciousness and change, obviously. But I think in her own life, that journey was marked by disharmony. It was marked by a sense of friction, shattering, and chaos.
Absolutely. And it's like, if there were, and that is just her story. It's like, if she had just a little bit more support, mm-hmm. there would have been, you know, she already is perfection, but she would have been able to maybe have been a legend and live to see it. You know, there's like, yeah. Which is, and yeah. So it's like her impact isn't lessened at all, but it may have been an easier experience.
Well, let's get into what I think of as the central kind of downfall, which is Veneno has Venus in Taurus, which is extremely powerful. Venus rules Taurus. Taurus, you know, if we think of in matrilineal goddess societies, Taurus was, the bull was worshipped because the bull's horns, signify the fallopian tubes, the crescent moon, which is the sign of the goddess. Bulls tilt the fields. They're very much symbols of fertility, agriculture, great. So Venus in Taurus is very powerful because she's really able to give you full goddess, full diva, you know, femininity like at its highest.
Cup runneth over.
Exactly. Ooh, yeah. So, right. And again, then we have that Jupiter in that sixth house of body. So there's just this sense of like, abundance, more than you could ever want. Like, I'm gonna give it to you, you know.
Also health, considering also the Virgo thing, because I think also people are so used to the queer being unhealthy because they are on the fringes. And she performs health.
You know, I love what you're saying because, and the show did this really well, a lot of the sex scenes where she's like with these like kind of diminutive men, she is this like vital, like Venus in furs, you know, diva incarnate. So that's incredible. Her Venus is in the seventh house of intimate relationships, collaborations, partnerships, and open enemies. So when I see Venus in the seventh house, and by the way, her moon is not far from her descendant, so we can think of her moon and Venus kind of clumped together there. It's, to me, you know, it requires a lot of work because essentially her, well, can you kind of explain what it means to have your Venus in that arena?
Well, to have your Venus in,
to me, it's like you have your open heart in this area of intimate partnerships. And to me, when I see Venus in the seventh house, I'm like, okay, codependency may be an issue here. Her Venus is not really afflicted. Well, it is afflicted, which we're about to get into in a major way, but it's very powerful. And the idea is that a Scorpio rising with Scorpio risings have their seventh house in Taurus. The idea being they're looking for a partner who can ground, stabilize, sustain, and support them, who they can trust, who's in it for the long haul. Great. When you have Venus there, though, it can, to me, lead, it goes right into codependency, and it goes right into this, like, I can't do anything. I can't support myself. Taurus is very much about money. I can't support or sustain myself without someone else. And her open heart gets kind of, like, claimed by another. How is any of that sounding?
Right. And also, it's like, also, just you take care of the money. Just you take care of it. Fine. Go for it. Right. Which, of course, was the downfall.
And if we look at that Venus, that Venus is opposed, so at a direct confrontation with Neptune. So, okay, Venus and Neptune, again, very good for, this is the fantasy. This is the femininity you could always want. I'm going to give this to you. I'm going to embody this. But also, sorry, were you about to say something?
I was just looking at the moon and Venus. So the moon is in the eighth house of other people's money.
Yeah.
And then Venus is in the seventh house of like the, she's having her codependent give the money. So she never handles money.
And her Lilith is in the second house of personal resources.
Right. So there is a complete inability or unwillingness to take responsibility for her own material security.
Yes.
So it's like, and she's emotionally dependent on making money through other people's gifts to her. And so she needs to be like the spoiled queen of the world, but then also she needs to take all of those spoils and give them to whoever she loves and have them be in charge of it. And
exactly. I mean, if we think about that Sun and Mars as the active elements, those are in, you know, Sun, Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, very active, are in work, pleasure, creativity, sex, the body. So she's giving it. But then if we think about that Venus and that moon, which are the receptive, they're in relationships and shared resources. And, you know, when we see Venus directly opposed by that Neptune, there is a deception there because Neptune is this fantasy. And I think her Venus was attracted to this idea of, you know, when we see Neptune and Venus, there's like a someday my prince will come thing going on there. And there's an aspect of like, why should she doubt that this man who came out of nowhere or this, you know, after she got out of prison, one of her next boyfriends stole 60,000 euros from her. He wiped out her life savings. And for her, it's because she is able to project a fantasy, but she falls for a fantasy too.
That's kind of the
tragedy. Yeah. It's deceptive love. It's like, it's an idea of love. And, you know, Venus is ruled by Taurus. Venus is also ruled by Libra. Where does she have Libra? She has her Libra in the 12th house. The 12th house is the house of undoing. The 12th house is also associated with incarceration. So there is this link between, you know, her lovers and her imprisonment, literally and figuratively.
Also, Taurus, we're two Tauruses, so we would rather this not to be true. But Tauruses, we love to put our heads in the sand and not have to face reality if it doesn't feel good, because we are total slaves to sensation. So I think about, actually, this is a wonderful lowbrow reference, but for people that have watched Real Housewives of New York, Countess Luann is a Taurus, and she is the most Taurus of Tauruses. And there is a whole season of her marrying Tom, who is a terrible man and will never provide for her or be loyal or anything. And the whole season is every other housewife being like, are you sure you want to do this? And she's like, he loves me. And it's so Taurus. So to have Venus there, it's just like, oh, but it's going to be fine. It's like all of the flags are waving, yeah, and you just refuse to look at them.
And I think it's hard with Scorpio rising
and Pisces sun.
And if we think about, you know, if we think about the first, fourth, seventh, and 10th houses as being the most like prominent, powerful houses, you know, when you have a Scorpio rising in that first house, then you have Aquarius in the fourth and Taurus in the seventh, those are all fixed signs. And we're talking about Leo is in the 10th. So if we think about those, fixed is very stubborn, it's very set. And then if we think about those houses we're talking about, we're thinking about selfhood, your roots, your foundation, your home, your relationships, and your public role, your career. So those are major. Right. And there is this idea of like, it's hard to, I'm not saying it's impossible. That's, astrology is all about making changes. Work with me, we will do it. But
free will exists.
Yes, free will exists, and like all of this is meant to be evolved, and clearly she had a great amount of power here, but it's hard to get someone to change their stripes. And especially when you see someone with Taurus in the seventh house, you know, when I'm reading someone and I'm like, hey, FYI, through 2026 the planet Uranus is transiting your seventh house of intimate relationships, I would just keep things open, you know, be open to change. Maybe this relationship might end. You know, it's hard for them to hear that because they're like, no, this is perfect. This is going to work. This is fine. So there is this kind of like a sense of doom there. And yeah, with that 12th house stuff, it's like her lover sent her to prison. Her lovers are responsible for her losing her money. I mean, so that is kind of tough.
Yeah.
I do want to say that I love the placement of her nodes, and maybe that's like, you know, a closure point for us, but her nodes, if we think about, the moon's nodes as the southern direction of the moon's elliptical is the south node and the northern direction is the north node. The south node in a person's chart kind of represents where they're coming from. You could say past life. I think it's like family life, lower consciousness. The north node is where you're going, your destiny, your higher consciousness. Does that sound okay to you?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Her south node is in Capricorn, in the third house of siblings, daily life, and like neighborhood. And Capricorn is very much like the sign of the state. It's very much the sign of survival. It's very much the sign of like daddy, capitalism, patriarchy, expectations. This is how you need to live your life, etc. So we have her south node there. So that's kind of where she's coming from, which is this kind of daily life, this neighborhood, this crushing siblinghood. But her north node is in Cancer. Cancer is the sign of the tribe. Cancer is very much the sign of the mother and the storyteller. And Cancer, she has in her ninth house of travel, publishing, spirituality, and God. And so there is this aspect of her highest consciousness, which a lot of which she didn't even get to live for, but I think she got to see with the publishing of her memoir, is that kind of, if we think of cancers, we think of Roy Sheen Murphy, Caroline Polachek, Charlotte Ginsburg. Like, we think of these kind of pop star storytellers. And her highest consciousness is to act as this kind of tribal mother who is relaying this story and it's like a life milk. It's feeding these children. It's feeding all of us, you know, who are in the next generation who are watching it.
Right. I think she is very much a mother to a generation of queers now, just by default. And especially being in that ninth house, it's like the impact just goes on and on, because her motherhood is traveling the world right now through the TV show, through the book. It doesn't end.
Yeah.
When she dies.
And you know, like her first Saturn return, the period of her first Saturn return, I would say, is 91 and 94, but her official Saturn return was in like January of 1994. But you know, she began her transition in 1992. So her first Saturn return was this Aquarian reinvention, right? And then when Saturn was hitting that Uranus, that Pluto, and that part of Fortune in Virgo, you know, she became a star. Her singles went gold. She's on TV. Right now, she, though she's no longer with us, is going through her second Saturn return period. And she's like being unleashed through these kind of new Aquarian airwaves, through streaming television, through things, you know, that are, didn't even exist during her first Saturn return.
So, right. Which, what a validation.
Yes, what a validation. And like, we, her queer children, get to experience it with her. What is there anything else that we didn't cover that you're seeing in this powerful chart?
In the chart, no. I feel like we've done a pretty in-depth look for a podcast. I remember when I was watching it, there's the scene where she is in the park and she becomes the superhero against the Grand Dame of the park. And
Fanny.
It was, when I saw that scene, that was the exact moment that I texted you. And I was like, you need to watch this show because this is you.
Dexter, what's psycho is that Ben Leary also sent me that clip and was like, did you write this? Because it's so like, with the rain, with the weapons, and with her being like, come here, bitch. Like, I have written that scene 100 times. Mm-hmm. It's so like X-Men. It's so just like Battle of the Divas. So thank you for seeing me in that.
And if you did write it, I would have been like, this is a little self-indulgent, David. We get it. We get your fantasy.
I know, like, tits out. I know. It's so, and then they're like fighting Nazis. Like, it's so, that really did it for me. Anyway, so I, again, if any of the actresses on that show, or if we could, I really want us to read Paca. I would love us to do it in dialogue with Paca. So my Spanish is not at the level where I could be translating like squares and conjunctions. So, you know, I am welcoming any supporters who would like to do that.
Also, Duolingo, get an astrology version. Okay, we need...
Please.
We're thirsty, we're hungry.
Please. Dexter, where can people be following you? And actually, if you just like to say, Dexter, like, you thrive at doing a certain kind of performance that our government and Instagram is trying to ban. So I'd just love to know if there's anywhere you'd like people to be following and supporting you, because you are such a star and so tapped in.
Bless you. Thank you. Well, my Instagram is at Dexter Driscoll. My Twitter, unfortunately, is at Dex for Breakfast because I couldn't get Dexter Driscoll. But if you go to either of those, also DexterDriscoll.com. Mm. But if you go to either of those places, you can easily find my OnlyFans. And also from there, I'm also a musician and songwriter. I'm really excited about the new music that I'm making.
Yes.
And it is at least a couple of singles are coming this year. The album is like halfway written. So we're getting somewhere, but music will be coming this year. So if you are interested, I would appreciate any follows, streams, etc.
You know, Dexter, not to harp on this, but it's just so interesting, like, what's going on with OnlyFans happening during a Saturn and Aquarius period, because we have this like Aquarius dissemination of free expression, this new form of monetary income, this very like, it's much more like of a reclamation. There are no industry gatekeepers. Great. And then we have Saturn, which are these like reverends basically who are trying to shut the whole operation down and ban it and block it.
Right. It's hilarious. It's like, it's obviously tragic, and it's also hilarious because it's like, people are like, oh my God, we can't let all of these like hot people sell pictures of their genitals. But then they're like, should we let Nazis like hang out together on the internet? And I'm like, okay. Yeah. But it is a very strange world.
And it's just interesting that we just had this conversation about Veneno, who has her Saturn in Aquarius, and we're like, still, you know, there is a lot of progress, but clearly like the battle is very much continuing.
Right. But maybe there will, just the way that she was, you know, an explosion, the last Saturn in Aquarius, it's the time for a new Aquarian explosion. So,
babe, I'm counting on you. I will be okay. Ready. thank you for doing this. I love you very much. And hopefully we'll do this again soon.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.